welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host and friend, Bob Scott, former co-founder of the Kansas City Fellowship and the author of three books, the latest is Some Said They Blundered, Breaking My Decades of Silence on Mike Bickle, the Kansas City Prophets, and the International House of Prayer. Bob, it's good to finally be back. We've had so many things that have come up on the time slots we usually record, and including some family emergencies and health emergencies, which I won't get into. But needless to say, everything is back to recording and normal and somewhat better. So glad to be back. The topic that you brought up for today is one that fascinates me and our listeners, I think. You have a different set of listeners than some of the other hosts. Mm-hmm. I think this set of listeners would be crazy interested to hear more because of exactly what you just told me. Whenever I mention the word, the phrase, the Klan, and I'm purposefully leaving out the other two K's because YouTube likes to block those videos. So we'll call it the club. In this podcast. There is a club that is one of the words has the word Klan in it, and there are two other K's. I'll just say it like that. And
triple K's.
Triple, and we'll call it the club in this podcast, so YouTube doesn't block it.
The triple K club.
Part of the reason why so many people aren't familiar with this is that I have trouble getting the research out because of exactly what I just said. I have released countless episodes, documents, things on Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, YouTube, and YouTube, when the moment they see this, and this is an important part of American history, when they see that phrase, it gets blocked. And sometimes I've got platforms that entirely take the video down, so I can't even put it out.
Wow.
So that's why I'm using the word the club.
Right.
But the important thing to understand, and now that I know how to get around it by using the club, the important thing to get around and to understand is that a lot of people associate that phrase, acronym, word with just simply an issue between white people and black people.
Right. It's racial. They frame it in a racial context.
Exactly. And it isn't that. And it has really big significance in the state of Indiana, where I live, where William Branham was raised, and where the latter rain really, if you look at the heart of how it was birthed, it, a lot of it came from Indiana because of Branham.
Right.
So there's a lot we can discuss, but I think it is important. I've done it with some of the other hosts, I think all of them at this point. We've talked about it to some extent, but we want to discuss today how the club, it was more of a religious movement than it was anything else, but it turned very nasty very quickly.
Yeah, so just to give you guys some context here, I was explaining to John that I have had a little bit of difficulty connecting the dots with some of the connections he made between Latter Rain and this club. And the reason being is because my perception of this particular organization was that it was based on being anti-African-American. That was the focus of it. Where did I get that? Well, at my age, which I'm 69 years old, I grew up during the 1960s, right? Civil rights, Dr. King, all of it. And everything was framed in that context, and that club was always brought into the conversation. So I grew up my whole life thinking that the primary focus of the club was to keep black people down, right? To put them in their place, to keep them subservient, right? So I've always had this mentality. Well, the reason why this is important is I was telling him that I, for years, have done racial reconciliation. I've been involved in stuff all over the world, and I have a little seminar I used to do called Perception, Perspective, Paradigm, meaning that the way our worldviews are shaped is that our five senses pick up data. They're like our little receptors. That's how we get our information through our five senses. Well, what do we do with those five senses? How is it interpreted? Like this data that we get. Well, we have perceptions. Well, if you study sociology, you find out that your subculture, which is your family, your friends, your peers, they form that, they take that data and give you a perspective of what that means, right? So we all grow up thinking we're normal, and this is how you view life. This is our perspective about a lot of different things. When those things become entrenched in a subculture to the point where it's like a set of rules, right? The unspoken rules. Well, that becomes a paradigm then. Like, it's locked in, right? And this is, and this stuff gets carried on. So here I am. I grew up during the 1960s, and I see the Klan always framed in this context of being a anti or a racially focused thing. I actually have a favorite little podcast that I listen to, which is two British guys that actually go back through history, and they take various events and kind of break it down. So this is hilarious that I'm actually learning this from these British guys. But anyways, in listening to the podcast, I had some epiphanies that were like game-changing perspective changers for me, which finally helped me fill in some gaps. Because as I was telling John, I have been having a hard time getting my head around the fact that this particular religious movement, Latter Rain, and its key leaders were associated with this Triple K club, right? As like, do they? I didn't know that they hated black people. That was always like, huh, this is a big leap for me. So I love John. I trust him. I know he does his research, but in my own brain, because of my perceptions and perspectives, I was having a hard time connecting the dots here, going, well, wait a minute, weren't there black people in these meetings? Like, wait a minute, like, how this is not fitting for me. Like, I felt like the puzzle piece that was like puzzle pieces on the table that I couldn't connect until this podcast. And in this podcast, what happened was, is they opened up my mind to realize that the Klan, especially the Indiana version, was not created to be anti-black and have a racial element to it. It was focused on stopping Catholics from taking over America and Jewish people. It was religious. And that was such a shock to me. I was like, what? This is the first time. I'm 69 years old. This is the first time I'm ever hearing this. I had no idea. I've never heard anyone talk about this. It's always framed, even on TV, even today when you hear it, it's always framed in a racial context, right? And I'm like, what? And so then suddenly my brain starts racing ahead, going, oh my gosh. And there was other events that I was too young to understand that suddenly start making sense. And I was telling John, it's like, I'm like curious about John Kennedy, because I remember as a little boy, you know, when Kennedy got elected, I think I was 3 years old. And when he got killed, I was six, right? But I remember there was this swirl around him. Well, he's the first Catholic president of the United States. I understand now why he was so controversial, right? It's like, we've never had this before. We're a Protestant nation. The Triple K Club was focused on keeping them at bay. It was like this war, and that was a kind of a aha, what do you call it, an aha moment for me. It was like, oh, okay, now this is starting to make sense.
You know, there's so much to tell. I'm going to be dropping random facts in this podcast almost at a machine gun scatter rate. But if you want to know the full history, you cannot contain it in one podcast. Yeah. The Revival History Series, which is on the YouTube site, and I'm rearranging the website. Soon you'll be able to find it easier on the website. It contains about 60 episodes describing this, but the history of the Latter Rain movement, basically what birthed IHOP KC and what predated even Latter Rain, was so heavily influenced by this club that we're talking about. And if you're just now joining in on the podcast, we're purposefully using the word club for I'll say it again. The Klan.
So we don't get censored.
There's so many times that you can say it before YouTube blocks as well. So we may have hit that limit at this point. But for the club, there are so many different details that tie it to the movement, the biggest of which is this. William Branham's mentor was the second in command of that club.
From Indiana, the second in command in Indiana?
No.
Oh, so there, in Atlanta.
There's a long history you and I haven't talked about because it does relate to IHOP KC, Kansas City Fellowship, in that it is the history and the genealogy of the movement, if you will, but it is somewhat disconnected. But so I'll just give you a 5-minute broad overview.
Yeah, that would be good because as I learned from listening to the podcast, there's three renditions of this club. The one that we're talking about, the second rendition, which was actually Rebirth in Atlanta, but then there was the split off, right? And they had a fight, a leadership fight, which is, so pick it up and kind of fill in the gaps for everyone.
Yeah. So specifically, I'm talking about the second and the third iteration of the club. The first one was in, I think, Pulaski, Tennessee.
Yeah, Tennessee.
1800s. So Forrest William Branham's
Edward or something, he was a Confederate general or something. So it was Confederate guys trying to keep the fires burning for the Confederacy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
William Branham's mentor was from Texas, and he was from a place in Texas where it is well known for issues, racial issues, and one of the highest lynching rates in Texas history. Near Paris, Texas, I think is where it was, which is where Branham's family also came from, we later learned in Branham's ministry. He was a bigamist, many different bad things that YouTube would also censor if I tell you everything that this guy did and was.
Right.
But long story short, he had a wife and children in Texas and rode the rails on a Christian revival circuit, preaching the gospel, and had his other wives in other places, and basically was living dual lives.
Right.
And he got caught in Texas. When he got caught, it was a whole bag of worms because he was the second in command of the club. He was working directly with William Joseph Simmons, who founded the second iteration of the club. The Klan was disbanded in about 1921 or 22, there was a big congressional inquiry because it had turned into a domestic terrorist organization.
Yeah.
At that point in time.
Political too, right? They had a lot of political clout, so they were a threat politically.
Exactly. What they determined was that they had invaded the United States. They had basically taken control of local and sometimes state governments. And so there's a congressional inquiry. At that point in time, William Branham's mentor, Roy E. Davis, was the official spokesperson for Simmons. And there was another name, William D. Upshaw, who was widely respected in the temperance movement. He's part of the reason why you can't buy alcohol in grocery stores on Sunday.
Right.
He and his team swept through the United States. He was also deeply tied to William Branham, and he is the one who defended the club in Washington and kept it from being completely disbanded in the early 20s. But William Branham's mentor helped write the Constitution, the bylaws, basically helped establish the second iteration of the club.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, whenever the congressional inquiry basically said, you can't do what you're doing, what happened is the club splintered into different factions, the largest faction of which was Indiana, as you mentioned, partially because one of the Klan's agendas was the anti-Catholic position that they had. They saw Rome and Catholicism as an invasion of the United States.
And the Pope was a bad man.
The Pope was a bad man, and Notre Dame was in Indiana, and that they saw that as basically the capital of Romanism.
That's a good point, yeah.
So
that's
Indiana,
in our backyard.
The largest club in the history of the organization was Indiana. And there weren't that many black people in Indiana. It was mostly about the Catholics. But more than that, they saw it as they were trying to spread what they called true Americanism, which is interesting if you think of today's politics, because they're using the same verbiage, lineage, and they're coming from the same roots that all of this grew and developed from. There was a moment in time, and this is the part where I'll stop dropping facts and hand it back to you. There was a moment in time when the leader of the club in Indiana was... they had taken control of the Indiana state government. They almost put a person in Washington who was one of their puppets. He wasn't really in any way affiliated with the Klan, but the Klan, the club controlled him. And it was at that point that it was learned that this head of the organization in Indiana was seeing mistresses, was drinking heavily, had cannibalized a person.
I learned all that. I was like, whoa, these are some nutty people.
It was in complete disarray. That is the moment whenever Roy E. Davis migrated to this area and planted my grandfather's church.
Interesting. Wow, that's so fascinating. Well, you know, I'm an author, so from an integrity point of view, I think it's always important to cite your references. So what I failed to mention was, what was the podcast that I listened to where I got all this information? And the podcast is called The Rest is History. And it's two British guys, and they literally every week go through some great story in history. And I just absolutely am a history fanatic. I just am so fascinated by human behavior and how things are happening. And what happens, the hard part about being somebody that loves history is that you sit there and you look at your TV and go, oh my God, do these people not realize we already did this 70 years ago? Did they not realize we already tried that 100 years ago? Like, this doesn't work. Yeah. You know? It's so frustrating, because you realize why, you know, when my kids were coming up through the education system, they weren't taught history, or what they were taught was so dumbed down. It's unbelievable how little the millennial kids actually understand about what's going on. Like, all this detail that you have, nobody was ever taught any of this, right? And so they have no context to the fact that, hey, do you not understand we already did this in the 1920s? We're just repeating something again. And history's, you know, it's like history just keeps going in these cycles. And the only thing that changes is the character in the play, right?
Yeah.
It's like a Shakespeare play that was written in the 1500s, and everybody keeps doing the same play, only we have different actors. And it's like, oh my gosh, that's what happens when you become a historian. You're just going, oh God, it's same play, different actors. So moving on, now that I feel better that I told everyone where where I was having this epiphany from, the second piece of this that just blew my mind was they talked about the fact there were at least, I think they said 40,000, we'll just say tens of thousands of Methodist ministers that were a part of the club. So again, here I am kind of going, wait a minute, I thought this was an anomaly. Like, it, again, because you're shaping it over here as it's a racial thing, therefore there shouldn't be any church people involved in this, or if there are, it's got to be rare. And when they drop this, the fact that, wait a minute, the Methodist Church is intimately involved in this, you kind of go, what? You know? But again, when you start thinking through the context of this, there's a couple pieces to this. One, again, when you realize it's anti-Catholic, you can understand why a Protestant organization would feel threatened by the influence of Catholic politicians, Catholic civic leader, right? In other words, they would see that as how do you want to say? It's almost like the Reformation again, right? It's this, only it's reverse Reformation. And where the Protestants are in charge, and now the Catholics are going to come take over, right? So it's almost like another kind of Reformation, and they're trying to basically keep this contained, right? But the other thing that people may not connect the dots with is the Methodists were very strong in Kentucky. In fact, if you know anything about church history, there's a phrase called the circuit riders. And the circuit riders were predominantly Methodist guys on horseback that would travel from, you talk about the moonshine and the hollow, right? All these little villages and towns back in these little mountain in the Appalachians. Well, these Methodist ministers would get on their horses and travel and maybe do 5 or 6 church services in a day, right? Because they were too small to have their own pastor or whatever, so they were on the road. And so you have, again, connection to Branham here with his Kentucky roots, right? So you've got this heavy influence Methodist Kentucky area with these circuit riders, and what are they doing? They're trying to make sure the Catholics don't make inroads into Kentucky and Indiana and all this kind of stuff. And to your point, they already had with Notre Dame. So Notre Dame is like the equivalent of Rome. It's like, oh my God, the enemy has now got a fort in our Protestant state, right? And so you can understand, if that's your worldview, right? If that's your perspective, you can understand then how all these people would then suddenly go, wait a minute, we're at war here, right? This is a threat. We got to stop this. And so that was the second piece of this. And then I'll give you the third piece, which I was telling John, what I didn't grasp and to listen to these podcasts was, again, we think of the Klan, because of the way it's been shaped for us on TV and in movies, that this is a violent organization lynching black people, and that's what they do mostly. Well, that's actually not true. What it was a civic organization very similar to the Elks Club, the Kiwanis Club, like all these civic organizations that we may or may not belong to, they were tied into. And if what's even interesting, and you can probably shed some light on this, was they were very connected to the Masons, right? And there was a little bit of a battle going on between the Triple K Club and the Masons, because the Masons go back to the Revolutionary War days, right? And they were the big predominant sort of club that all the, you know, judges and business guys and big civic leaders all join. And suddenly now there's this other club, right? And people are joining them. So there was this weird tension between these two organizations, right? For dominance. But when we think of the Klan, we're thinking of guys in white hoods burning crosses and lynching black people. When in Indiana, this is picnics, parties, carnivals. It's, you know, it's like everybody's having a blast, and everybody belongs to it, because that's how you do business and make relationships, and it you know, like you do when you join an organization now. So it that suddenly makes sense to me, suddenly, why you'd have so many pastors, people like Branham, you know, Pentecostal churches, all be a part of the Klan, or the Triple K Club, as we say, right? Because they're not looking at this as evil. They think they're doing good.
So some more scattering of random facts, and I'll begin with, my grandfather was a Methodist minister. So.
Okay, well, there you go. That makes even more connection.
But the thing to understand, and there's really not enough time in this podcast to show the sheer complexity of it, but you did have all of these fraternal organizations, like you mentioned, the Masons, you had a whole variety of these things, and it was common back then, so common that the Flintstones have the Order of the Water Buffaloes. that's why you had that in the Flintstones.
Exactly. Everybody's with the big joined. Hat, the horns.
Exactly.
You would be the Grand Poobah. His whole outfit, right?
You did have all of that. But these guys created the notion that we needed a Christian version of this. So what happened was, you had a group of men, I can't remember how many were the original for the second iteration. I think it was 7 men or 14 men. Anyway, among those original people, they defined the Constitution, and I've got a copy of it on the website, you can read it. They defined it as a Christian fraternal organization, but they wanted to create it with the same mystic feel as some of the other fraternal organizations. That's why you have some of the strange names of the different people who are in the tiers, right? So they've got all of this presented to the people as a Christian organization.
To your point about the funny names, these guys are going through the list of the names and they're laughing so hard they can't hold it together because these names of these different levels are absolutely freaking ridiculous. I mean, yeah. it's comical. Like, you're sitting there going, are you sure is this in a comedy sketch here? But this was like real, to your point.
But the idea, the reason why they did that is much like the Flintstones, they wanted to make it fun. It was supposed to be fun, Christian, and fraternal. We want our own fraternal organization that's Christian. What happened was, much like many of the cults that we examine on the website, because you had leadership who really, they were calling it Christian, they were framing it as Christianity, but some of the people who were leading it weren't really Christian. Roy E. Davis being chief among them. I mean, while he's writing this constitution and bringing his wife to this thing, he's got another wife back in Texas, and he's got young women, I'll say it like that. And keep it YouTube clean, young women that there's some inappropriate things happening. I'll just say it like that.
Yeah, so lots of inappropriate things, though. It's not a little bit. It's a lot, right?
This is a whole trail.
Seedy underbelly to this thing.
It was horrendous.
Yeah. And
so you had people who weren't really Christian who were leading it and swaying the policies. And at the same time you had this being birthed, it became widely popular. It turned into a cult. It was a movement, right, much like some of the other movements that turned into a cult. While you're part of this cult, it became dangerous to defy it. So in some of the cities, if you were doing something that opposed the local guy running for sheriff, for example, and the sheriff was part of this club, well, you might have people at your door beating you up because you voted for the other guy. That's how bad this got. And that's why the congressional inquiry, because they were trying to stop the idea that an organization can become so large in the United States that it can sit outside of the government and actually control the government from underneath. And that's what was happening with this movement.
Wasn't there a musical like in the 1960s? I think it was called The Music Man. Didn't it take place in Indiana? But the guy, it's about a con man, right? And the reason why this is interesting to me is because when you start unpacking this, what you realize is these guys that you're talking about that are leading this, they're not actually Christian. What they're building is a multi-level marketing organization because they're all getting super wealthy because you have to pay memberships and you get recruiting fees. Like, so when you bring somebody in, you get a slice of their, like, everybody got a piece of the dollar, right? And so there was a motivation to recruit people. But the people at the top were all con men. They were, in other words, they were using a particular religious and / we'll call it civic issues to make money. They actually hired two people to do marketing. That was the whole thing, right? This is so funny because I'm listening to this going, oh my God, this is Christianity 1980s. Because I've talked about this in previous podcasts where in the 1980s, there was a whole movement of business consultants that came back into the church world and took all the marketing principles from the business world and just put religious words on it. And we all got church growth seminars. And where you see all of the marketing and I call it the perception game in the mega church world, right? It's all based on what happened in the 1980s when there was a big shift away from local congregations, you know, where you had a pastor and it was family, and there was to these big, massive institutions with millions of dollars and a celebrity, a star, television, radio, you know, that was exactly what they were doing in the 1920s. So so put this into context for people. One third of every male in the state of Indiana was a member of the club. So again, this is not an isolated, radical, extremist, group like we all think. Yes, some of the people that were involved were kind of crazy and criminal, but the average person that was involved in this wasn't necessarily somebody that was radical. They were just regular families, people raising their kids, trying to be a part of a town or a village or a city and have friends and hang out together. So the people at the lower levels probably weren't as engaged as people at the higher levels in the ideology realm, which is pretty typical even now with the political parties, right? It's like it's the people at the top that are all the ones spouting the ideology, while most people down at the bottom are sort of like bobbleheads, you know? It's like, okay. But yeah, and so that's really fascinating to me, because now it starts making sense to me why the Latter Rain movement would have been connected to this, because I was having a hard time understanding the why. Like, why would this group of people want to be associated with such a racially motivated organization that's full of hate, right? When you bring it around and go, wait a minute, they're against a particular religious organization called the Catholics, and they're against Judaism. And then you go, oh, right? Now, you know, I mean, people may not be aware of this, but the founder of the modern mass production system and the founder of Ford Motor Company, Henry Ford, was a virulent anti-Semite. And there was a whole pamphlet that went around. I called it something called the Elders of Zion or something. It was a whole thing. Like, he was like passing that all around to his friends. So this whole concept of this was not just, again, fringe people. These are some of the major people in our country. The next step to this, of course, is the whole concept, racial purity. So that's where some of the racism enters into this thing. But again, it's based on Darwin and the whole, that's not entropy. What's the word that for racial purity that the philosophy begins with an E? Anyways, it was Darwin's cousin that started this, right? That we need to have, you know, a purer race of people, which was, that was happening simultaneously in the 1920s. Woodrow Wilson was a major proponent of it, right? And what you end up finding out is that there's a connection between Woodrow Wilson and the Klan, or the club, I should say.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the Latter Rain, Charismatic, and other fringe movements into the New Apostolic Reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. So I'm going to scatterbomb you with a few more random facts, but I'm going to bring the timeline forward to what you're talking about with Latter Rain. So to get from the point I was talking about before into Latter Rain, Roy Davis moves into this area. He plants the church that became my grandfather's church, William Branham's Branham Tabernacle.
Right.
There were many elders in the movement in that tabernacle who were Masons, and I've got that research on the website. Yeah. Branham himself said, the Klan saved my life, Masons. Yeah. So he was saying that they were Klan and Masons, connecting the two. Well, Davis gets caught and arrested right off the platform in a revival because of a young girl, 16 years old, I think, that he had carried across state lines for apparent purposes that he denied. I'll say it like that and keep it clean. Right. To a young girl he later married on the West Coast. So he gets caught. He escapes that, but gets caught for something else down in Little Rock. I think it was Little Rock in Arkansas, near where later the Assemblies of God would be formed, etc. Well, he gets arrested. He goes to prison for a period of time, reemerges in the Los Angeles area. He actually planted a church became pastor of a church in San Bernardino. They create an orphanage scheme, which was something that the Klan did often during the years when they went underground. They would create a front. The front would fund the organization, and then they would grow and develop, spread, etc. His front was connecting donations, and there were two sets of accounting books. All of that is in the court trial that came out. William D. Upshaw, who I mentioned saved the Klan during the second iteration in the 20s, moves out here with him and set up a Department of Americanism for these orphanage, which is basically advertising, we are the club. That was really all that was. The whole thing gets caught, overturned, whenever some wealthy donor figured out, hey, my funds aren't supporting the children. What's happening with it? There's a huge court trial. But this is at a period of time that is critical to several things that we've mentioned in other podcasts. Eugenics was
one of the words you were looking for.
This came after the second Klan was formed, but think of the breeding ground. The Klan basically spread the ideology. Now all of these other ideologies that were similar started to creep in. One of them was eugenics. The other one, which you mentioned, Henry Ford, the Anglo-Saxon Federation was in cahoots with this organization in spreading the protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. They started printing it right in the Henry Ford's Dearborn Independent magazine, and they published one of the most anti-Semitic documents, International Jew. And the International Jew was published, it was spread, it was propaganda, but this propaganda machine caught on. So fast forward just a bit further, now the third iteration of the club is being formed, and it starts actually in California. History doesn't record that properly because they missed the whole Roy Davis thing. Davis is funding it through this organization. Then you have other leaders who would join into this. One of them is Wesley Swift, a name that I've mentioned. Big Christian identity guy who was trained in Amy Semple McPherson's Life Tabernacle. The Klan helps Amy get out of her kidnapping scheme that she had done to cover up her sexual misconduct. The Klan comes and helps her. Well, she gets in bed with Gerald Burton Windrod, who we've mentioned, who is helping to spread the protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion.
Wow.
His organization starts working with Charles Fuller, who founded the Fuller Theological Seminary, from which John Wimber and others, C. Peter Wagner, were in. And she has Gerald Burton Windrod occupy her pulpit during times whenever she said she was unavailable, one of which was the week after, the very Sunday after the Night of Broken Glass. And they were strongly, vehemently against what most of the American citizens were saying about Germany. They actually supported Germany in some cases, and that apparently was one of the cases.
Yeah, that's one of those, what do they call that, uncomfortable truths in American history that people are not really taught was. There was a whole part of our country that absolutely thought Hitler was the bee's knees, as they say, right? He was the future.
Exactly. What's like that with any cult? You have, whenever you're taught that the propaganda they're spreading is Christian, and you're taught ways to defend that version of Christianity, it becomes your ideology, and you'll fight to the death over your ideology. Well, that was happening. Right. It wasn't until after the Holocaust that people started saying, wait a minute, this was not quite right, what I was doing.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know what? I think if I ever got inside your brain, it would look like one of those like giant libraries, you know, that you see where you got to get up on a ladder to get like way up there. It's like your brain is filled with just volumes of cool facts. You know what I mean? Now, I'll give you something and you can keep it in or cut it out. But, you know, one of the things that people now probably would not comprehend because it's such an offense to us in our modern world. But old guys with young girls was not weird in early 1900s America. Being with one that's not married, that was the problem, right? That was kind of the line. And the reason I bring this up is people may not be aware of this, but Grover Cleveland, who was president of the United States, actually married his ward. And what I mean by that was, is he had a very close friend who told him, hey, if I should die, take my daughter and raise her, which he did, right? And then he married her. And she was like 30 years younger than he was. And they all loved her in Washington. And nobody thought it was weird. So you have the president of the United States, like, you know, who's in his 50s with a young 20-year-old, you know, running around Washington, and nobody cared.
That continued in the South. My mother used to go across the street and play with this young girl. I can't remember her age, might have been 13 or 14, and she would go up into the treehouse and play with the little dolls. They weren't Barbie back then. while the little girl's husband went to work to pay for her treehouse. Right. That's how, and you know, I look back and I think that's just disgusting because we've been taught that it's disgusting. Right. And you know, to some extent, I do believe it's disgusting, but back then everybody had a different frame of mind.
Well, it's kind of like the concept of normal. You know, I love when people say normal because my brain always starts going, okay, like, what do you mean normal? Right? Because it's like a, you know, it's like a, like when you're looking at a video and you take the little thing and you want to go back and listen to something, you take the little bar and go back. Well, history's like that. Well, over here, at this particular time, this is normal, right? But then if you like take your little thing and go back 100 years, that very thing that you think is normal is absolutely disgusting. Or it's the other way around, right? It's like women in the 1920s, if they saw the beach with women in bikinis, they would be absolutely horrified. Like every woman on a beach would be called a name, a very disgusting name in modern America if you interpret it through the lens of somebody from 1920, right? Things in 1920 that were normal are now disgusting for us. And so I always find that concept of normal kind of an interesting word because it has to be contextualized. Well, what was normal when? And it's not only on a timeline, it's also in culture. So these are some of the things why I think it's important we have these kind of conversations, because when you make connections like with this, you know, this group to these religious people, if we don't contextualize it, you completely misunderstand what's actually going on here, not realizing that in everybody's mind, this is perfectly normal. We're all having a blast, right? And we're not lynching anybody. It has nothing to do, like never even thought about that. What we're really scared of is we're scared of those people up there in North Indiana who've got a foothold in our state, right? And they're going to bring a religion here we don't really want, right? And then, right? And if, again, if people understand geography, what's right near Indiana? What's just south of Ohio? Kentucky, right? Probably the epicenter of Methodism in American culture, right? And why is the Methodist, right? So it's all these little connections that you start realizing, oh, wait a minute here, right? The thing that I find fascinating about all this is how something's changing and yet it's the same, right? And it's like, wow, we've got all these organizations where you got a bunch of con men at the top, you know, trying to make a lot of money, and they have all these wonderful things they're saying and preaching and whatever, but it's really all about the money.
Yeah.
And it's like the ideology is a means to an end, right? And the reason why I bring this up, because I have seen this all over the world in the not-for-profit world. I have my own organization that I've worked with in Africa. And I cannot believe how many people that are in the not-for-profit organization actually could care less about the people that they're raising money for. What it's all about, really, is making money. I had a dear friend, this is again a sidebar here, I have a dear friend who created a homeless shelter in Aurora, Illinois. And I love this guy dearly. Well, he calls me one day and goes, you're not going to believe this, but they asked me to head up a big civic not-for-profit organization in Washington, D.C. I said to him, go, Ryan, be careful, buddy. I don't think you realize what you're getting yourself into. He was thinking it was a promotion. You know, it was like, oh, my God, I'm going to actually go to Washington and make a difference, right? Because he's like a local pastor in a city helping people every day who are homeless and hungry, right? Then he goes to Washington, and he lasts 2 years. And he's back in the homeless shelter. And I go visit him and go, what happened? He goes, nobody actually cares about the poor here. It's all about how much money I can make at this organization. He goes, there's no loyalty. Everybody's flying around, hopping organizations. It's like it's like the whole thing, the poor are a means to an end. It's not really about caring for people. And so I feel that way sometimes when I get into certain aspects of the church world. That's why I'm a huge fan of local church pastors who are down there in the trenches day in and day out with a group of people that they care deeply about, and they're involved in their cities. And I have a hard time with the mega church mindset, the television programs, and the marketing side of this whole ministry world, where you're using Christianity as a means to another end, which is to increase your standard of living and live, I call it living large, right? You want to live a large life. And the truth of it is all those people sitting out there are a means to their end, right? Just like what we're talking about this club, right? It all sounds great until you realize the guys at top are all con men. They're the music man from, you know, what is it? River City. I'm trying to remember the melodies, right?
There's a song, Gary, Indiana, that's in there.
Yes, that's right. So it's starting to come back to me. But yeah. I remember that as a kid, right? And I'm thinking when I was listening to all this, I was like, wait a minute. I think there's a movie about this. Now, one very fascinating piece of this, which you and I should probably explore at some point. But you know what famous novel came out around the same time? Wizard of Oz.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And one of the discussions is the Wizard of Oz have in it, like, is he, you know, because there's all kinds of moral truths in the Wizard of Oz, like, underneath this, right? But it's from this, you know, even though it takes place in Kansas, it's all about this world. And it's like, well, wait a minute. Is he really going after these wizards, right? I gotta go to the and what was my favorite line for the movie? Don't mind the man behind the curtain, right? and so my, you know, everybody thinks Dorothy's the head of the show, right? You know who my favorite character is? Toto. Because what does Toto do? He's like, we're Toto. He pulls the curtain back, right? And what's behind the great wizard is these feeble little men, right? Who are all trying to pretend there's something bigger than they really are, right? And that's what ends up, as you're pointing out, and we have to be very careful here, because these are not just feeble little men behind a curtain. These are very gross men. Like, they do some disgusting things to women. It's like gross. And yet, here they are, ahead of this civic organization that's saving America, right? And from these, you know, this religious influx of Catholics, right? So, and of course, for people that want to understand American history, Catholicism, like so many other things, came through the East Coast. And the Irish were very, you know, very strongly Catholic, right? Some parts of Germany were. So, you know, you'll see Boston and Rhode Island was a Catholic colony, right? So it was there from the beginning. It just was kind of small and insignificant. And over time, it kept growing and growing. And then in the early 1900s, what were the two biggest groups of people that immigrated to America? Irish people and Italians, who were what? Diehard Catholics, right? So now you've got that whole dynamic. So you can see why this group of people is feeling threatened, because the U.S. government now has just brought in a whole, wait, does this sound familiar? 100 years later and it's the same thing all over again. Oh, it's a different group of people this time, right?
It sounds really familiar. And in fact, it's more familiar than you know, because I have written this book, Preacher Behind the White Hoods, that talks about many of the random facts that I'm putting out today. There's a That's reason good. Why this book exists, and it isn't what people think. I had a YouTube site. It was called Seek the Truth. Uh-huh. That was my first YouTube site. And basically, I had all of these random facts published, and I had collected enough that I started doing a docuseries, and I was heading up to about what I was, to the point in time that I'm about mm-hmm. to say, and I got an onslaught of attack. I actually lost the YouTube site. And so I've had to be very careful. When I lost the site, this is a funny story I've told once before. I was distraught because I was that close to just walking away and never talking about this again. It was my exit strategy. And they brought down my exit strategy. So I'm sitting in a hotel at probably 3 a.m. on a wedding anniversary. And the thought hit me, well, I have the video files. And I know software, so I cracked into the code behind the video files. I got there was a transcript bar running at the bottom, so I got the X and Y coordinates of the transcript bar, ripped the text out of it, and programmatically wrote this book. This is
You're a spy.
Yeah. So this is a programmatically written book. I did have
with all the data that you did on the.
Yeah. But it's got all the references. You can go see where.
Oh my goodness.
You know where I put everything in. Anyway.
So it gets into the why behind a lot of things. So which is really important.
And it comes full circle to what you asked earlier, JFK.
Okay.
This was significant.
Yeah, explain JFK, because again, people may not understand. We never had a Catholic president.
The scary part about this is, if you look at, and I also can't mention the names in this, or YouTube also blocks me,
right.
But look at some of the previous elections, and you see the same exact thing happening in a different way with different people, but it's the same thing.
Right.
So Kennedy comes into candidacy, and it just, there's this sudden outcry from all of the Pentecostals, the fundamentalists. Everybody right. hates this guy. Why? Because he is a Catholic and he's supporting civil rights. Everything that the club stands against he's fighting for. At a time whenever there was this push by the government to enforce the integration of races in schools, the law had already been passed, but there were so many people fighting it, they hadn't actually done it. So Kennedy's coming into power. William Branham's mentor, Roy Davis, and Wesley Swift, who I mentioned earlier out of Angelus Temple Life Bible College,
right.
they joined forces in Little Rock, Arkansas during the Little Rock 9 event. I've got all the FBI documents on my website.
Woolworths.
Yeah. They are trying to reestablish a militant version of the Klan and succeeded. Fast forward just a little bit. All of this moves down into Texas and Louisiana, and this is basically the rebirth of what was created in 1915. Davis actually mentions this.
Wow.
He becomes the Imperial Wizard. He is now so high level in the group that he's almost untouchable.
Right.
According to the FBI documents that I have, there were so many people who had infiltrated the politics, the government, the FBI, the police force, you can't really determine who's who. One of the detectives found that the wanted for treason posters of JFK was published by William Branham, his mentor, Roy Davis, on his printing presses.
Right.
And so these printing presses were widely used, distributed. You had you had so many different things happening that was related to the fundamentalist anti-Catholicism Christian motivation behind the movement. The Davis becomes more and more outspoken, and suddenly it enters into the movement that JFK is today's Ahab, and Jacqueline is today's Jezebel. So we had Ahab and Jezebel, and once they get into the White House, this is horrendous.
Right.
JFK comes down into Texas. There's one FBI report that actually names William Branham's mentor as a shooter.
Wow.
I don't think that happened, but
right.
There's enough.
But wasn't sorry to see him get assassinated. Let's put it that way.
He wasn't sorry. And he was helping to incite all of the anger against JFK that could have likely caused it.
So are you familiar with the story of how JFK, how they got over the hump so he could become president with votes? If, for people that may not be aware of this, JFK's father, Joe Kennedy, made his money as a bootlegger, an Irish bootlegger during Prohibition, right? He made a deal with the Ohio mob. Again, who are the Ohio mob? Catholic Italians. And so the mob was the ones that ended up getting him over the hump so he won the state of Ohio. And so that was always been one of the things that swirled around behind the whole JFK assassination, because then they go after the mob after he becomes president. And so there's always been these theories that maybe it was the mob that did it, right? Which it seems that wasn't necessarily the case. But nonetheless, again, we're back down to this religious thing. It's so interesting to me because underneath some of these historical stories, it's about religion, right? It's and why I'm where I can circle this back to today, it's the same problem that we're seeing in the Middle East right now on television, where everything's being presented as this political thing and it's all about nations and whatever. And people don't understand that when we took out Saddam Hussein after 9/11, we got ourselves in the middle of a 1700-year-old religious war that's been going on with Islam. Like, we stuck our nose in the middle of something that's been going on for centuries and still going on. And a lot of what you're seeing presented on television underneath, they're not really telling you that there's tribal wars going on and things that have been going on for hundreds of years are actually in play right now. And that story never gets told, and that's why I think it's always important when we're looking at things on the surface or being told with things, you got to go kind of another level, and you got to always ask, what's the spiritual dynamics here? What are the religious dynamics? The secular press doesn't ever want to talk about it unless it's against something, right? It's particularly anti-Christian at the moment, but I'm just saying, they don't want to go there, but yet it's there. It's infiltrated everything. You can't disconnect the religious worldviews, even in modern America right now. It's you know what I mean? So it's kind of like this whole concept, and I've said this to people for years, that you start to get caught in the church world as there's a secular and there's a sacred. There's this. And while that may be true on the surface, underneath these two things are absolutely integrated. You can't separate them. And they are influential in all kinds of worldviews and how people think and how they vote and all kinds of stuff.
Exactly. In fact, there are key figures in power right now who are part of policy that if you question those key figures, and even if you say things about them, they right. start coming to your door. So I can't even really go deeply, but I will say some of those people are tied to this research that I'm talking about. The other thing that I'll say, you mentioned the mob, which is kind of funny because remember back in the Indiana time period that I'm talking about, when Roy Davis comes in, he's arrested off the platform, Branham's right here. Branham's family was also in the mob. They were part of the distribution of liquor. So this whole thing comes to weird connections and circles that are just spiraling as time goes on.
I had a kind of an aha moment with a group of people. They had called me to talk about my book, about IHOP, right? And I've never told any, I hardly told anyone this, but I actually had written the book 6 years earlier. A lot of people, most people's perception was that this happened, therefore I went and told my story, and I wrote it after the events had happened. Actually, that's not true. What was happening was, it was during COVID, I wasn't doing much, and my children didn't know my story, And so I decided what I was going to do was tell my story. And then when I died, I was going to give it to them with my, you know, when they were reading my will, I'd go, here's your dad's story, right? Well, I shared it with five friends around the world who all said to me, do not let this go public. You will get crucified, right? So it was very funny after, you know, after everything blew up, you know, in October a couple years ago, a lot of the IHOPers were yelling at me going, why didn't you tell us this, you know, years ago if you knew this? And what they don't understand was they would have been on the front row throwing spears and rocks at me because I said it. You know what I mean? Yeah. That's what people don't seem to understand. I would, and my friends were right. They said, you will not only have every leader at IHOP attacking you, right? You'll have everybody around the world coming at you. There will be no safe place for you. Right. And so I actually kept it. I buried it. I kept it on my computer for like 5 years. Never told a soul. Only five people in the world knew that I had written it. So isn't that funny? Because again, it's just like you're saying, it's like if you come out against the system.
Yeah.
And that's why there's many mafia. There's a religious mafia as well, right? You and I both know it. We've seen it. It's like religious denominations can function just like the mafia. They will take you out.
Absolutely. I mean, there are people, whenever this book was published, there are people who helped to take those videos down, which contained the content of this, wow, that spread the rumor that John's doing all this for money.
Right.
And yeah. I put it out there for free on YouTube. It's not like that, you know, the whole thing, when you get real deep into the weeds of what this mess is, you start to realize that it's not really Christianity. There's something else polluting Christianity behind it. And like I said earlier, it did take me an entire series of podcasts to fully untangle what this mess is. And if you want to see it, you can go to the Revival History series on the podcast.
No, that's good. I think that's well worth people's time. And it's important to drill down and understand the why. Otherwise, you misinterpret what you're seeing or hearing because you don't have a good context for it.
Yeah.
So yeah, well done on your part to kind of get that in writing. And now there's a record, right?
Absolutely.
It's there for posterity.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. This has been fun. We'll probably do some more on this theme later because I have more to tell as it relates to IHOP KC, but for now, people can get the general idea.
Yeah, hopefully we've been helpful and didn't freak anyone out and kind of gave them like a aha like I had. I was like, oh, wow, I did not get this. Like it was going over, it was going around me, right? It was like I felt like I was in the middle of something and it was going around me and I couldn't connect the dots. And thank you for doing this because it's like so many things suddenly are making sense to me.
Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR. And for more about Mike Bickle and IHOP KC, you can read Sub Said They Blundered, Breaking My Decades of Silence on Mike Bickle, The Kansas City Prophets, and The International House of Prayer. And I probably should have mentioned Preacher Behind the White Hoods, A Critical Examination of William Branham and His Message.